Now we're going to open up to questions from reporters. So if you want to ask a question, either raise your hand or put a note in chat with your name and that you want to ask a question, and I'll call on you. And when I call on you, give both your name and your publication, if you don't mind. So our first question is coming from Lila Yunus. Lila, which publication are you from?
Hi, I'm from Grist.
Great. What's your question?
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the data that was analyzed for this report. My understanding is that it's federal data that came online as a result of the 2015 Kolesch rule. So if you could talk a little bit about whether that's all sort of contained in one federal database, what that's called, and how it was analyzed, including sort of maybe the major fields, that would be great.
Abel, yes, from EIP, go ahead.
Yeah, there's no federal database, unfortunately. So the way the rule is written, every company is required to monitor their groundwater, write up some groundwater monitoring reports, and then post them on their own website. So every company, NRG, Duke, whoever it is, has a website, and you can go to their website, you can find all of the information. And that's where we got the groundwater monitoring data. So the database is something that we created because it didn't exist otherwise. And the way we analyzed the data was by evaluating, sort of the way the rule is designed to do, evaluating the levels of contamination in the downgradient wells, which are the ones where you might see some contamination, comparing that to the background wells, the upgradient wells, where you expect to not see the contamination. And if the groundwater is greater than background and above health-based guidelines, which are for the most part the same as the groundwater protection standards in the rule, we decided that that plant was contaminating the groundwater. Now, the caveat there is that we took industry's word on what the background wells are. And that's problematic because a lot of times those background wells are contaminated and it affects the whole groundwater quality analysis. But with the exception of one plant, Stanton, which was very obviously wrong, we took their word for it. And so we think it's at least 91% of coal plants that are contaminating the groundwater. It could actually be quite a bit more.
And of course, those companies are posting that data not out of the goodness of their heart, but because they were compelled to by the 2015 EPA Kolesch rule. Does that answer your question?
All yes, right. That's perfect. Thank you.
All right. Next question from Lester Graham. Lester, tell everyone who you're with.
Yeah, I'm with Michigan Radio. I'm interested to know, we're seeing a lot of these coal-burning power plants decommissioned right now. How does that affect or complicate this issue?
Lisa Evans, you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So simply shutting down a power plant, and of course, that's absolutely wonderful for the environment. It'll end the burning of coal and the emission of fossil of global warming gases. But that does nothing to correct the contamination that has already occurred on site. So decommissioning a plant will leave the plant owners with the responsibility to clean up the groundwater, the soil, whatever they have left at the site. And the federal rule does not discriminate between plants that are shut down or plants that are operating. So the plant owners have a continuing responsibility to clean up the contamination. And that is only fair for those communities which have been under the burden for so long of the air and water pollution caused by that coal plant.
Does that answer your question, Lester?
Yep, thank you.
All right, next we have a question from Amy Green. Amy, which publication are you with?
I'm with WMFE NPR in Orlando. What is the enforcement process supposed to be for these regulations? So like, why are the regulations not being enforced, and how is that process supposed to work, or what, you know, how should it work?
Abel Russ, you want to tackle that one?
Sure, yeah. There are two or three options for enforcing the rule. It's not like a permit program where you can get them when they do their permit renewal and there's an automatic moment in time when they have to demonstrate compliance. It's self-implementing. So the industry does follow all the steps in the rule the way it's written. And if they're not doing it right, EPA can step in and enforce the rule. States can step in and enforce the rule as citizens, or everyday citizens can enforce the rule if they can find the resources to hire a lawyer and an engineer and sue the company in federal court. That's how it gets enforced. And starting in January of this year, EPA started doing that in a number of different ways, not always through legal proceedings, but they are starting to enforce the terms of the coal ash rule. They've looked at 15 or 16 sites. We think there are hundreds across the country that are out of compliance in one way or another. So there's a lot more that EPA could do. There's a lot more that the states could do to make sure that these companies are following the rules.
Lisa, do you want to add anything? Lisa Evans?
Well, I would just point out that there are three states. So EPA has enforcement authority over all the coal ash sites. Although it's a little more difficult in the three states that have gained control of their own program. So you have Texas, Georgia, and Oklahoma, three very problematic states with lots of polluting coal ash sites that have the primary enforcement authority. So those states would be primarily responsible for enforcement in those states. And just to comment, we have not seen those states take enforcement against some very dirty plants in their states.
Okay. Our next question is coming from Ryan Kroll. Ryan, which publication are you with?
Hey, I'm with St. Louis's All Weekly, the Riverfront Times. Just one really quick clarification here. The ash tracker map is really helpful. It says like pollutants above safe levels. I'm just curious, can you tell me a little bit more about that safe level? Is that set by like the EPA, or who is that defining that safe level?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated, but basically it's the same as the groundwater protection standards in the coal ash rule. So any chemical that has a maximum contaminant level, which is an EPA national primary drinking water regulation, that MCL will be the groundwater protection standard in the rule, and it will be the health-based threshold that we use on our website. The things get a little stranger for the pollutants that don't have MCLs. And so, for example, a pollutant like boron doesn't have an MCL. We use an EPA drinking water advisory. Similarly, sulfate is one like that. There's not a national primary drinking water regulation. So we use health-based guidelines from EPA if we can't find a standard equivalent to the groundwater protection standard under the rule.
Cool. Yeah, some combination of the two. Got it. I appreciate it.
So basically, it's this groundwater, when we say safe, we mean safe for drinking.
Nice.
Correct. There's a lot we could say about that, actually, because the way the whole rule is, it was designed to prevent harm to human health and to aquatic life. But the cleanup, the groundwater monitoring, the cleanup standards, all of that is really tiered to the human health-based guidelines. And so there are places like the Brandywine landfill in Maryland, for example, where you might meet health-based guidelines for humans, but you're still creating a problem for aquatic life. And so it's a great point to not forget that that's also happening on the side, and we should be paying more attention to it.
And there are places like in northern Indiana, the town of Pines, Indiana, that Tim Maloney was talking about, where it was actually in people's drinking water. So it's a serious thing to look at. Our next question is from Robert Zulo. Robert, tell us which publication you're with. You can unmute yourself.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself there. I'm a national reporter with States Newsroom. We're a nonprofit news outlet with 30 outlets across the country. I was covering Dominion's coal ash plans in Virginia around the time the CCR rule was promulgated. I was wondering, is it correct that this the closure rules around ash impoundments that are in contact with groundwater is a new interpretation of the rule? I saw some discussion about that, like that this is a kind of a new thing that the EPA is a new interpretation. That the ponds can't be closed with coal ash in contact with groundwater. I was wondering what you had to say about that.
So we've always interpreted the rule to mean that, and EPA didn't really have to, you know, didn't say anything about it up until this year when they felt like they had to start enforcing the rule because industry was doing it wrong. I don't think it's a new interpretation. It's just the first time EPA has said anything other than what's written in the rule. So it's just the way the rule is written. I think you can't really read it any other way. It's just not allowed. You can't leave coal ash in groundwater when you close a unit. Industry would like to think that you can, and they try to read the rule that way. But mm-hmm. if you read some of EPA's recent compliance determination letters, for example, they explain exactly why the letter of the rule does not allow that.
Yeah,
Evans, go ahead.
It's absolutely not a new interpretation. That is what the rule said. You've got to remember that this rule was promulgated in 2015. Followed by 4 years of the Trump administration, where the EPA did nothing but try to remove the coal ash rule. So they did not try to enforce it. There were no pronouncements on what the rule meant. And so in January of this year, as Abel said, EPA has started to enforce the rule, but it is industry's argument that they are doing it in some new and novel way, which is total nonsense.
I see. And just one quick follow-up. Is it the CCR rule or the Clean Water Act that would require groundwater remediation if there was contaminated groundwater on site?
It's the coal ash rule. Yeah.
Because I know another case we covered in Virginia was whether contaminants leaching from a coal ash impoundment constitute a point source or not. I know there was a lot of litigation around that, so I was just curious.
Right.
So it is under this.
Yeah. These sites can also violate the Clean Water Act, but the one we're focused on, the groundwater cleanup standards and everything we're talking about, that's all under the coal ash rule. There may be separate causes of action under the Clean Water Act if the contamination is getting into a river or stream and it's a point source discharge and, you know, there's a legal story there, but yes, it can violate both.
Okay, thank you.
A comment here that I wonder if Abel and Lisa could respond to. The federal regulations only cover the active coal ash ponds, not closed ponds or ash recycling. Could you all comment on that and how that impacts our report and what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good observation, although let me clarify that the present coal ash rule covers inactive ponds, but if they were at a plant that's still producing electricity. So the commenter is right that what are called legacy ponds, which are ponds that didn't accept waste after the effective date of the coal ash rule, which was in October of 2015. Those were initially excluded from the coal ash rule. In addition, all inactive landfills, whether they're at an operating plant or at a retired plant, are completely exempted. So that is quite a large group of ponds and landfills. Over 500 units we know, and we're still counting. And that is, we are asking in our report for EPA to address and regulate those ponds and require cleanup, which is why I said EPA must require cleanup of coal ash wherever and whenever it was disposed. It all contaminates groundwater, air, surface water the same way. So we are hoping that EPA will take those actions soon. And in fact, on the issue of legacy ponds, which again are those ponds that are inactive and are at sites that aren't producing power, we won a suit in 2018. The Court of Appeals in DC ruled that EPA had to address those ponds. So again, we are waiting for the EPA rule that extends the reach of the CCR rule to cover all of those sites.
All right. Our next question is from Rocky Kistner, a journalist from DC. Go ahead, Rocky. Try to unmute yourself.
Got it. Hi. I'm an independent journalist in DC. I have a question about structural fill coal ash. It's used a lot in construction, golf courses, things like that. And does this report address that at all? And if not, are there any concerns about it? Because it's used in a lot of places.
Abel Russ, you want to tackle that one?
I can, yeah. Yes, it's definitely a concern because what you're talking about, and we see this in various places, using coal ash as a fill material like that is essentially like creating an unlined landfill. As far as the interaction between the coal ash and the underlying geology and groundwater is concerned, it's the same thing. You can put a coal ash, you can put a golf course on top or a parking lot or a school or whatever, but you just have a coal ash landfill underneath. And we feel like those should be built, designed, regulated the same way as any other coal ash landfill. So we are concerned about some of the exemptions for what gets called beneficial reuse. That is an evolving legal situation. Lisa might be able to talk more about, you know, right now it's not an ideal scenario. It's still happening sometimes, but we're trying to narrow that loophole a little bit. Some of the other uses, construction materials, wallboard, cement, some of that stuff is a little bit different. The product is somewhat contained and, I don't want to say that's good or bad. I think it sort of depends on how it's done, but there are ways to reuse coal ash, and there are good ways and there are very bad ways. And we see a lot of the bad way, unfortunately.
Thank you for that. I'm just curious because, you know, it's used in golf courses near schools, things like that. And I'm just wondering if there's ever been any legal action taken around that or if there could be.
Well, EPA currently has, well, under the, they say they're in the process of looking at what we call unencapsulated ash or coal ash use as a substitute for soil as fill. You know, you've mentioned a golf course, this golf course in Virginia that has turned into a Superfund site. The use of coal ash as fill in the town of Pines also created a Superfund site. I mean, there's no question that the use of coal ash as a substitute for soil should be prohibited. As Abel said, it's coal ash, it's going to behave like coal ash. You're allowing essentially landfills to be built without any safeguards. So that is certainly on in our list of asks in the report. I think every report that we have issued, since the CCR rule has asked for that. And it's among the many things that EPA has to do to strengthen the coal ash rule and protect people's health.
Our next question is from Steve Singer, reporter for Utility Dive. Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you very much. What would be a solution for these sites? Is it merely just to cap them, or is there a disposal? I'm just wondering what the long-term solution is to get rid of them or make sure that they're not interfering with public health, damaging public health.
Yeah, I'll take this real quickly, and then Lisa may have some other thoughts too. I know we both think about this a lot. The rule requires two kinds of things. One is source control. So you isolate that coal ash from the environment so it's not going to continue to leach toxic chemicals out. So that means basically keeping it high and dry. You get it away from the aquifers, you get it out of the floodplain, you don't put it on a fault line, you put it in a place that's stable and dry and not in a floodplain, and you line it and you cap it and you can leave it. And that's what the rule requires for new landfills. And that's basically an adequate way to deal with the ash. And what we see at a lot of sites like the Allen site in North Carolina, which is very contaminated, is one of our top 10. What Duke is planning to do, not necessarily of its own volition, in part because of a lot of great advocacy in North and South Carolina, in part because of North Carolina executive actions and enforcement actions, they're going to excavate all of the coal ash from the ash ponds in North Carolina. And what they're doing at the Allen plant is they're digging it up and they're putting it in a new dry lined landfill right next to where it is now. It's on the property. They don't have to take it very far, but it's going to keep it out of a more dangerous place, and it's going to keep it in a safer place. So that's what we think should happen with the coal ash. The other thing that the rule requires is cleaning up the groundwater. And that gets a little bit more complicated. There are lots of ways to do that. Pumping it out and treating it is one way, for example. It's really site specific. It depends on the site, depends on what the consultants think is the best way. What doesn't work is monitored natural attenuation, which is not really a remedy of any kind. It's just waiting. It's dilution and dispersion, which the coal ash rule doesn't allow.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think Abel has covered it. I just want to add that one of the reasons I chose to work on coal ash, although it was 20 years ago, was that there are solutions. There are solutions to clean up. There are solutions for relatively safe disposal. This is not a problem that can't be solved. The problem is the intransigence of the industry in not being willing to solve the problem.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions? Raise your hand or put a note in the chat if you have any more questions. I have a question here from Amanda. Amanda, why don't you go ahead? Amanda Strotterman, what's your question?
Hi, thanks. I'm not a journalist. I'm just trying to understand this position from someone who's an advocate in North Carolina. Since North Carolina did have a cleanup order to drain all the coal ash ponds and fully excavate them to lined landfills, what is the main concern for groundwater at this time? In other words, is it that the cleanup's not happening quickly enough, or should community members here really be pushing for that groundwater remediation?
Well, that's complicated. You know, it's site specific. That's where the devil's in the details, really. Whether it's fast enough, I don't know. I know Duke is planning to do it. I know they've started the process of removing the ash at Allen and some other sites probably. The groundwater treatment is, you know, what you do with what's left behind after the first phase of the cleanup is done. And I think the thing that I would recommend advocating for, what we advocate for in the report, is that companies proceed more rapidly to the point where they have a cleanup plan that they're committed to. A lot of sites, I don't think any of the sites in North Carolina have selected a final remedy yet. They're doing stuff that is a form of corrective action, but they haven't actually picked that remedy and they haven't committed to what it's going to be. They haven't committed to a groundwater treatment plan, for example, and they can't tell you how long it's going to take to restore groundwater quality. Those are all things that are required by the rule. It's possible to do it. Some plants have done it. So that's what we think everybody should be doing. That's what we are advocating for.
A couple quick things here. Someone asked to get the audio of this press conference. You can either email me at tpelton@environmentalintegrity.org and I'll send you a link. I'm also going to put it up on our press section of our website, a link to it afterwards. So either look on our website in about an hour or email me and I'll email you the audio recording. We have a question here from Logan Stefanich. Go ahead, Logan.
Hi, yeah, I'm with KSL.com in Salt Lake City. So I'm kind of concerned with the Pacific Corp's Hunter power plants near Castledale. It's one of the top 10 most contaminated per the report. And my question kind of concerns horizontal groundwater collection. The Hunter power plant selected that remedy for their cleanup, but the report says it might not be adequate. So I was just kind of wondering if someone kind of explain what this remedy is and why it's not seen as adequate for this specific plant.
I'll try. This is one for an engineer, but my understanding is that it's a form of groundwater capture. So you put these horizontal wells under, it's like a French drain in a way. The leachate, the contaminated groundwater that's coming down through the soil underneath the ash landfill or the ash pond is collected in these horizontal wells, taken out and treated. But the question is sort of what that treatment entails. And I want to make sure I don't misstate anything. So I'm just trying to look at the Hunter site. One of the problems at Hunter is that they claim that the remedy is working already, but the evidence actually shows that it's not yet. And maybe that's the nature of that particular groundwater treatment system. But what in fact we see is that some contaminants are increasing in concentration in the groundwater, despite having those horizontal wells in place. So it's for one of the problems is just really the way it's being misrepresented in the industry reports where they say it's working and it doesn't actually look like it is working. We think that might be a little bit problematic. Another problem is that the remedy design process was limited to two pollutants, lithium and molybdenum, even though there are some other pollutants that are present at unsafe levels. And it'll be important to figure out if the remedy will actually address all of the pollutants or only the two that they chose to sort of highlight. So it gets really complicated when you drill down on any particular site, and we think they're doing something at Hunter, but it doesn't quite seem to be good enough yet.
Thank you.
We have one comment here. Lisa, can you speak on suing Duke Energy to treat the decanted coal ash pond water before they dump it into the lake for cleanup? All states need to treat it, as it was pretty much too late for North Carolina. Are you familiar with that case, Lisa?
That was not a case I was involved in. I think the concern, just backing up, the concern that the contaminated water that sits on top of the coal ash, that utilities have been routinely siphoning off and dumping into the nearby waterway, is not sufficiently regulated and not regulated by the CCR rule and neither by the Clean Water Act. I think Duke got into a lot of trouble at one of the sites for doing a bit of midnight dumping there. That was many years ago. I'm gonna ask Abel whether he is knowledgeable about that case.
I'm not. I don't want to misspeak. So I no.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I can see that although there are not sufficient rules to guide the disposal of that decanted water. I agree that it must be done carefully, and the contaminants generally settle to the settle in the water, so that if it's done more slowly, that's better. You're going to get less contamination, but certainly the water has to be, that you are dumping into a nearby stream, has to be thoroughly tested and should not be tripping any exceedances on pursuant to the safe to the Clean Water Act cleanup. Permit. The problem is the permits may not even have those contaminants in the permit specifications. So it could be a problem.
The one thing I'll say about that is EPA is scheduled to propose a new coal ash effluent limitations guidelines, the Clean Water Act regulations for coal plants, sometime this fall. And that will change the legal landscape again for the water that's discharged from ash ponds and from things like that. So the regulations that apply to decanted water are about to change again. That's the only thing I can add. Not very helpful.
And if the person asking the question wants to email me with that question, I can talk to folks on the this is called the effluent limitation guidelines that Abel's talking about. We can provide more information about that, because we are hopeful that EPA will address that issue in the new rule this fall.
Okay, any final questions? Raise your hand or put a note in the chat. I think that should just about cover. Oh, Molly DeVore. Go ahead, Molly. Which publication are you with? Unmute yourself.
Yes, hi, sorry. I think.
Oh, you're muted. Molly, I think you might be muted. Go ahead. Oh. You could put your question. Go ahead, Molly.
Okay, hi. Sorry, can you hear me now?
No, sir.
It's a little bit broken up. Maybe you could put it in the chat real quick, and I can.
Okay, let me try that quick.
Having some audio disruption. Just type a question in chat, and I will read it out loud to our panel. While Molly is writing out her question, anyone else have any final questions? We're going to wait for Molly's question to come in, but if anyone else has any other questions while we're waiting for that, just a couple of things here. If you have any follow-ups, any need for more information or explanations, you can reach me, Tom Pelton of the Environmental Integrity Project, directly at 443-510-2574, or you can email me at tpelton@environmentalintegrity.org. I'll be happy to either find the information or set you up with our experts who can find the information. Also, go on our website, www.environmentalintegrity.org. We're going to have links to the audio of this press conference posted in about an hour. And we also have on our press release links to all the databases and maps that we talked about today. The Earth Justice website also has that same information, and we'll be able to have the same maps and databases if you want to look there. Let's see if our question has come in here. Well, I don't see it quite yet. I think, Molly, why don't you go ahead and send me an email, tpelton@environmentalintegrity.org. And we'll make sure that you get your question answered and all the information you need. All right, I think I'm going to wrap it up. Thanks for everyone attending this event and participating. Thank you for your time, and thanks for your interest in this issue. And have a great afternoon.